Hey guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with Peter Gruber. He is the CEO of Gruber Motor Company, a company that deals with the electric vehicle industry. And we had connected on LinkedIn and wanted to learn more about his work. He's worked a long time in the industry, which is kind of unique for an industry that is obviously making huge inroads in the past few years. So I wanted to get his take on the industry, his work, and where we stand in terms of, you know, what that means for the economy. So Peter, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Sure. I'm glad to be here and offer any information that I can.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background? How did you get involved with EVs, and like, how did that interest start?
Well, I've had two passions all my life, the first one being electronics, even as a kid, and the second one being cars. And it wasn't until late in my life that those two finally merged. For about 40 years now, we've been in the high-tech business, manufacturing data center type products, fiber optic cables, patch panels. We service critical power equipment, UPSs in data centers, lighting inverters, so lots of electronics over the years. In 2014, I bought a Tesla Roadster. After having a couple of Priuses, my wife and I wanted to go green, and I finally decided I would like to get 100% battery electric vehicles. So nothing interested me out there until I saw a Roadster for sale in California. Turns out it was George Clooney's black Roadster.
Nice.
And his agent couldn't tell me who the celebrity was. They're pretty secretive, but I put two and two together. Anyway, before I flew to California to purchase the car, I had a local friend here that had a Tesla Roadster, and I asked him what he thought of his. He loved the car, but he had two little girls, and it turns out the airbag doesn't turn off on the passenger side. So he was going to sell his car. We struck a deal, and I drove my Roadster as a daily driver for about a year or so. One morning, I was taking my lunch bucket out of my trunk of the Roadster, and one of our field engineers that works on critical power equipment looked at the big black box that was next to my lunch pail and asked what that was. And I explained it's a three-phase inverter. And he pointed out that we repair those. And it suddenly occurred to me that we've been in the Tesla repair business all along, just didn't realize it. So within a couple, 3 months or so, I had hired someone off Craigslist of all places, brought him in as a manager, a depot manager, with an expectation that he would develop our Tesla business along with managing some technical functions here. And we got our first customer from the Bay Area. He was facing a $10,000 power electronic module replacement from Tesla. And we said we can open those and repair them. So for $2,300, we gave him a not only repaired power electronics module, but a completely rebuilt module. And the word quickly spread that we have unique skills that can compete with Tesla.
Wow.
From that, the Roadsters began to flow in from all over the United States. And
how many Roadsters are there total, if you don't mind my asking?
There were originally just slightly over 2,400 made globally. Mm-hmm. About 2,000 of those were in the United States. And currently, there are only about 2,000 left globally, with about 1,500 in the United States. So it's a very small population, which is another reason that we began to branch out into the other Tesla vehicle platforms, starting with Model S. The type of work that we do is generally electronics based. Most people look at a Tesla and think it's a car. It's really a computer on wheels. It's quite a bit different. There's some low tech stuff in there, you know, the brakes, the suspension, and the some of the mechanical parts of it. But fundamentally, the big challenges with repairs are the electronics. And there are plenty of them, from a 1,000-pound battery pack in a Roadster, 1,200 pounds in a Model S, to a bunch of electronic modules and boards and assemblies. And the third component is firmware, software. These cars, you can't even change a door handle without redeploying firmware, because each of these parts is intelligent in some way and has to be realigned with the Unix software.
So do you have the software engineers on staff too, or is that something that you cooperate with Tesla to be able to integrate into what you're doing in terms of repairs?
That's a good question. Part of what makes us successful is, unlike auto shops, which are attempting to migrate into this EV space, who bring only mechanical skills with them, wrenching skills, we were able to bring not only software skills into the equation, but also electronics and reverse engineering skills. And the reason I say reverse engineering, for 40 years, we've been battling with the OEMs of the critical power world. They see us as a competitor, and they won't give us any support. They won't give us the time of day. And we have to reverse engineer and develop all of our own documentation, test procedures, schematics, the bill of materials. We simply applied that same procedure to the Tesla products. And before you know it, Tesla looked at us and said, how the heck are these guys doing what they're doing? And before too long, they realized that there was some synergy available here. And today we're in partnership with Tesla, helping them with their old first generation Roadster vehicles.
So what are the primary issues with something like a Roadster, which obviously was a first generation vehicle for Tesla? What are the main issues for a Roadster? Like, is it battery life? Is it technical breakdown in terms of the computers? Is it wear and tear on the vehicle itself?
The wear and tear on the vehicle is, obvious. Suspension components, shocks, brakes. The primary thing, though, that fails on Roadsters is two areas. The main battery pack. There are 6,831 lithium-ion vape cigarette cells in a Tesla Roadster that are crammed into a 1,000-pound box. And oftentimes, there are problems inside that pack. First of all, the Roadster was really a prototype that was pushed in the field before it was ready. And the fundamental reason was to avoid bankruptcy and get these cars in the hands of the owners that had prepaid for the cars. Fortunately, the compromises were not in the areas of safety or performance. They were in the areas of serviceability. So working on a Tesla Roadster is not for the faint of heart. To get inside that battery pack, to work on the electronics takes about a day to properly disassemble the suspension components and drop out that big pack. The second failure point in a Tesla Roadster is the electronics. And what people don't realize is that electronic products have a shelf life, basically. There are components inside that are aging, things like electrolytic capacitors that are drying up with age and becoming resistant. Then there are engineering problems in the Tesla Roadster, like the IGBT transistor insulating material is crumbling and drying with age, eventually shorting against ground. At the time the cars were produced, no one anticipated this material wouldn't last but more than 5 years or so. So we have a lot of age-related electronic issues, and our approach to solving that is to rebuild the assemblies, which is the same thing that you do to an internal combustion engine car. You change rings, pistons, bearings, and gaskets, and except in our world, it's the electronic components that get upgraded and replaced. The other compelling reason for doing that is they stopped production of the Tesla Roadster in 2008. And parts are no longer available. So the only way to keep the cars alive is to have people like us that can troubleshoot down the component level and proactively rebuild along with repair.
So when you replace the component parts with the electronics that you described that were breaking down, based on the technology now, are you able to give those electronics a longer shelf life in the performance of the vehicle? Like, they only lasted 5 years. Can you extend that life farther for the vehicle going forward? Or is it simply a 5-year expectation of having to turn that around?
Well, we wish that was the case, because in many types of components, there are improvements. Unfortunately, the types of components that are most failure prone, like the electrolytic capacitors, for example, there have been no quantum leaps in improvement in technology. It's still basically a dielectric that is wound around some metal and will dry out with age.
Gotcha.
Where it gets scary is in the aging of the components and availability. We just ran into another problem this morning, actually. There's a MOSFET that resides inside the DC to DC converter in a Tesla Roadster, which is prone for failure, or prone to failure. It turns out that that part has been out of production for many years, and the lead time we're getting now is January of next year. Well, nobody wants to wait that long to get their car back. And then it's murky as to whether that part will be available even after January. So if we had the ability to rebuild boards and rewrite software, we could upgrade a number of components in a Tesla Roadster. But the problem we run into is, with a gene pool of only 2,000 cars, there's just not enough business to get return on investment for that kind of effort. So we're really stuck with attempting to keep the cars alive with the old technology that's buried in the car.
Is there a way, using the technology, and like the Model S came next, is there a way using the technology and the Model S to be able to substitute into the Roadsters, or is that just a completely different schematic in terms of a vehicle?
The problem there is, although there are advancements to the Model S drivetrain, it is a completely different geometry. And the Roadster is actually a Lotus Elise, which is a little carbon fiber sports car, basically. To try to cram Tesla Model S or even later platform hardware into the car is a daunting challenge from just a logistics standpoint.
Gotcha.
But the final problem is the firmware would have to be rewritten, and certain other electronics would have to be redone. And again, with such a small customer base, no one in the independent space where we are has seen the return on investment to be able to even begin that project.
So does the Roadster then have a finite lifespan, you think, in terms of their usefulness?
The question there is related to the valuation as time goes on. It is my personal opinion that the Tesla Roadster enjoys a unique status in that it is the first EV that really launched a revolution in a highly disruptive market. So, and it's also limited edition. It's small, it's sexy, it's sporty, and it checks all of the check boxes regarding collectability, even though it's only been out for 13 years. So the answer to that is, once these cars begin to reach the early Ferrari valuation status, $20 million plus, I think all kinds of magic will happen in the independent space, because now you can monetize and get return on investment. But at today's valuation level, which, by the way, is more than twice what it was a year ago, at about $100,000, there's still not enough valuation there to motivate or encourage independents like us to invest.
Gotcha. How does the battery technology, it's evolved some in the past couple of years. How does battery technology affect EVs going forward, not just the Roadster, but in general? Like, is there, do you foresee an extension of range, so to speak, that comes with where things are headed in terms of battery technology?
Well, very much so. The ongoing challenge is to pack more energy into a given space, and that's well underway. The problem in using these types of new products retroactively is, again, the the static or the fixed hardware and firmware in this older car. There will, of course, be a large cottage industry eventually electrifying old classic cars, for example. And with the way that things are going now with a number of countries and states eventually banning the production of ICE vehicles and eventually banning them on the roads, that guy that wants to keep a 69 Mustang alive is going to have to electrify that vehicle. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be a large cottage industry of manufacturers making conversion kits for those older cars.
Gotcha. Well, one of the interesting things in the past couple of months is how hard companies like Ford and GM are moving into the electric space. And I imagine that kind of changes the landscape going forward for people like yourself who are in the business of repairing. Obviously, you're ahead of the curve, but there's a lot of businesses out there that, you know, they're still basing their mode of operation on internal combustion engines. I mean, that has to be a substantial economic change. What do you see happening in terms of that portion of the economy?
Well, the new players coming into the EV space are going to have a much easier time of creating product. The old tenured companies, Ford, GM, are going to have a difficult time converting their assembly lines over to an EV process or running them simultaneously. Hmm. There is a lot of speculation, but there are many people that are even wondering whether these tenured manufacturers will be able to survive since they were having problems even before the EV revolution began. Mm-hmm. The new companies have a much easier time. They have fresh assembly lines. Where they're going to have problems is in the once they start releasing product. You can't catch all of the problems that are inherent in a design. Tesla found that out. Every new launch has problems, panel gaps, paint. We have a good video on that, by the way. It's called What's Wrong with Tesla. In there we discuss, if you're looking for a car that has perfect panels, perfect paint, perfect interior, you need to go buy a German car. You're not going to get that from one of these new manufacturers that are still refining their QC processes.
Mm-hmm. What role does a lot of the technology, not just the batteries, but also the electronics and so forth, are based on rare earth metals? I imagine that that's going to be kind of a supply constriction going forward with all of these other players coming in. How do you see that? Kind of how that affects the economy?
Well, the manufacturers that are doing the most volume are going to get preferential treatment. For example, Tesla does not appear to be suffering from a chip shortage.
Yeah.
As I read just recently, GM is actually shuttering plants because they can't get chips. Mm-hmm. Again, it's going to be the high volume producers that are going to be at the forefront. There's also an exciting movement underway with recycling. J.B. Strobel, for example, the CTO of Tesla for 15 years, now with Redwood Materials. And, there's some exciting procedures that they're implementing to recycle lithium, for example. I think the capture rate is in the 90%+ rate.
Wow. With
recycling, which, of course, is... definitely a value to the planet.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. In terms of, there's a lot of argument as far as with the move towards electric vehicles and the pollution generated by trying to mine the materials for electric vehicles versus an internal combustion engine vehicle. What's your take on that? Like, what's your pushback against the argument that EVs might be more polluting?
Well, on the back end, of course, it's difficult to quantify the impact that a electric vehicle build has on the environment. It's far easier to look at the front end. My wife and I, for example, both drive Teslas. And we've gotten to the point where when stuck in traffic, we're actually able to smell all of the fumes that are coming in through into the cabin. Mm-hmm. I guess my other answer to that would be, having gone through COVID last year in Phoenix, Arizona, it changed our complete climate here. You were able to see the stars at night.
Wow.
You didn't see clouds of smog. You could see the mountains in the distance.
Simply because there were no cars for from people going to work?
Fewer cars, exactly. So the impact that fossil fuel burning vehicles have on the environment, I think last year was a wake-up call, or should have been, that is definitely having an impact. And then, of course, there's a lot of, there are many schools of thought about global warming. Some people still believe that it's a conspiracy. You know, everything that I read and hear indicates that it's coming from so many different sources that it is undeniable. Mm-hmm. The scary part is, will we be able to do something quickly enough? I think our lifetime is, we're okay, but I'm worried about my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Are we going to leave them a habitable planet when it's all said and done?
Well, even in yours and my lifetimes being okay, I mean, I would even question that, just based on the forest fires that we're seeing and the flooding and so forth, you know, rampant around the world. You know, how do you quantify okay, you know, how things are changing and how quickly they're changing? So that's tough.
I agree.
As a business owner, what would your advice be to the Biden administration? They have a number of bills to try to build back better, you know,
regenerate.
Yes. See, trying to light a fire under the economy. What would your advice be to, if you were an economic advisor to the Biden administration as a small business owner, what can be done to shift the economy into a more sustainable mode of operation, akin to what you're obviously successfully doing?
I had many strong opinions until the last couple of years or so, watching the economy. We've been in business 40 years, and my general position was, let's leave government out of the equation and let free enterprise run itself, because it does a pretty good job on its own. And then COVID came along, and suddenly we've got a workforce that was idled. We have benefits that are exceed what I'm able to pay. We had a shortage of labor. And it seemed like we were printing money like crazy. And the only way, or the only reason, in my opinion, it seemed to work is because the whole planet was in the same boat. I really don't have any strong advice for the Biden administration, except leave us alone out here, because businesses like ours, we do about $20 million plus per year. We are really the backbone of the American economy. It is not the mega companies or the tiny little companies. It's companies like ours that are really making a difference and keeping things alive. But of course, with the current administration, more government control is definitely not part of their agenda.
Would you think that part of the agenda seems to be to reduce the influence of larger companies, anti-monopoly legislation and rulings and so forth? Would you think that that would encourage mid-sized businesses, or do you think that's hurtful to businesses like yours as well?
Well, large companies monopolizing certain markets is always damaging to small businesses like ours.
Yeah. So you'd be, in that case, not opposed to something like that?
I would not be opposed to something like that. We've had examples of that. For example, I talked earlier about all the reverse engineering that we had to do because mm-hmm. we got no support from our large competitors.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't only end with no support. It actually extended into a very hostile position that they would often take. To give you an example, one of the critical power manufacturers, well known, I won't mention their name, we need parts, and they have proprietary parts, and we have service agreements on units that are their brand, for example. The only way we can repair that equipment, and we have an obligation because we have a service agreement on it, is to get parts from the manufacturer. This particular manufacturer wouldn't directly not sell us parts, but they would play games. Yes, we have the part, but in order for you to get it overnight like you need it, there would be an expedite fee, which is usually double the normal inflated retail cost. And if you're willing to wait, it's going to be 3 to 4 weeks. It's those kinds of games that they would play. We attempted to get the government to intercede in cases like this. And I found that the red tape, and I tried for 2 years, was just stifling. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get anywhere from the local level all the way up to the Department of Justice because there were definite federal violations were taking place when that kind of activity took place. So yes, to answer your original question, the large companies can be ruthless and attempt to control competition.
Mm-hmm. Well, your particular business operation obviously is very successful. Do you, in terms of kind of future economic plans, do you foresee expanding what you do, franchising, for example, your idea, or you've already done a lot of the footwork, so to speak, to be able to service cars like you've talked about? Is there an opportunity to franchise or to kind of expand your footprint to a larger economic impact?
Oh, very much so. On a weekly basis, we get at least 2 to 3 requests per week from companies around the world, actually, asking us to train them, franchise them. They want to fly people here to an internship to learn how we do things, or if we're able to franchise and share our intellectual property with them. The problem that we have is our procedures and processes have not yet matured to the level where we can scale. And even if we wanted to open up in other parts of the US, which there's definitely enough business there to do that, there's a serious shortage of talent, people. Mm-hmm. In our world, working on electric vehicles, it is such a new and disruptive technology. There are no places we can go to find people. I can't go to the local Nissan dealership and poach mechanics, because if I bring them in here, they have no clue how to work on electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are 3 distinct skills that are necessary. It is hardware, wrenching, working on low-tech auto. That's a foregone conclusion. But that isn't the majority of it. The majority of it is going to be software and electronics. Now, I can go to electronics shops and hire people all day long, but they're not going to want to work out in the shop area without air conditioning, getting dirt and grease under their fingernails, and wrenching. Mm-hmm. They like working in clean lab environments. And so it's very difficult for us to scale anywhere because there are no local people that I can count on or populate the facility with. There are people back here that we could ship there, but they're in short supply as well. with the demand that we currently have on just Tesla business. By the way, we used to do all the EVs that were available 8 years ago or so, from Priuses to Chevys and Fords. Today, we work on only Teslas, and we're very busy just handling that brand, with more coming online as the Teslas come off warranty. Just to give you an example of one of the reasons that people ship us their Teslas from all over the country. When a Tesla Model S is out of warranty and the 8-year drivetrain warranty has expired, and that car goes to a service center, 2012s, 2013s, 14s even, and they find that the main battery pack has a failure, the local service centers are not equipped to drop that battery pack, open it up, do component level repairs. Their only option is a brand new battery replacement, which costs $22,000. The problem is, this is a $25,000 to $30,000 car, and the customers choke on that bill, especially when they're used to getting free service for the last 8 years. So they send us those cars, have them transported here from all over the United States, and our repair on a battery, once we open it up, is usually in the neighborhood of about $5,000. So it's about 25% of a repair from the OEM. And I don't anticipate that the other EV manufacturers are going to have any different model, service model. Because at the service center levels, they can't staff with people that know electronics. They can crack open a battery pack and find that resistive cell and use the sophisticated test equipment that's necessary to isolate those types of problems. Now, the other thing that we haven't talked about is our position regarding competition. We talked briefly about that one large competitor that's very hostile. Our position regarding competition has always been synergy, partnership. I have never found a competitor where we've had 100% competitive overlap. So a smart businessman finds the areas of synergy. You can turn a competitor into a customer and into a vendor. So that's exactly what we've been doing with Tesla. And today, Tesla actually refers us in many cases, especially for the old legacy vehicles, where they have limitations on skills and staff.
That's awesome. That's impressive. Well, clearly, this is kind of an education on some of the roadblocks to where the economy needs to develop in order to accelerate growth, right? I think there's a lot of potential growth, but there's hurdles here that obviously you've come across and overcome that, overall the economy needs to be able to deal with, especially the labor issue and the training in a very large regard.
The major change that we saw, James, was a few weeks ago when the unemployment benefits finally ran out. Our ads now for staff actually became fruitful again. And good. People began to show up looking for work, and we're beginning to restaff. But I think one of the biggest mistakes that the federal government made was this continued support of in paying out more than the industry was paying.
Very good. If people want to learn more about the work that you do, especially with Teslas and so forth, and have their car shipped there, how can they reach out to you, Pete?
Well, we have a YouTube channel, Gruber Motors, or a Gruber Motor Company. We have Instagram and TikTok accounts, and our website is grubermotors.com.
Very good.
There's a lot of educational material on our website that talks about what happens to the Teslas as they age and the types of problems that we run into.
Very good. I'll include the website address in the description, but I appreciate your taking the time today and having the patience to sit with us and share your experience. It's been very enlightening. I appreciate it.
It's been our pleasure, James. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Take care.